I have 32 years with the Sheriff's Department. I just retired in February. I have the institutional knowledge. I have the credibility as a reformer. I spoke out against corruption in the Lee Baca and Paul Tanaka years. And I've been an advocate and a reformer my entire career with the Sheriff's Department. And this time in our history, we need someone who actually knows how to lead the department. We don't need a career bureaucrat. Everything is driven by cronyism. And I'm going to end that cronyism system and actually put into place a system that we're rewarding public service.
L.A. County Sheriff candidate Alex Villanueva on KCRW a few weeks ago. Villanueva declared victory on Friday, but he's inheriting a department filled with problems over the years. In a moment, we'll hear how he might reshape it. But first, the campfire in Northern California is currently 66% contained. The death toll has risen to 77, and 993 people are still missing. But that number is a quickly moving target. What does it reflect, and how are authorities going about the search? We're joined now by Erin Aylworth. She's been covering the California fires for the Wall Street Journal, and she's been writing about the search. Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. You know, this number of missing people dropped yesterday for the first time in days from 1,202 to 993. So tell us about those 200-plus people. What do those names tell us about the tally and what it means?
Well, that's a little bit hard to say. Those 200-plus people are simply people that the sheriff's office has heard from, essentially. The nearly 1,000 people that are still unaccounted for, he's been very careful to say are unaccounted for. He won't quite go as far as to say missing. And the reason for that is because Sheriff Honey has put some caveats on that number. It comes from several different sources. He consistently calls it raw data that hasn't yet been scrubbed for any sort of duplicates or any other issues. So it is simply a number of people who have been reported as not seen or heard from by their loved ones. Whether they're actually missing remains to be seen.
And in terms of the search for the missing, then, because we're going to talk about the burn areas in a moment, but where are authorities looking besides the burn areas? Because you have evacuees staying in all sorts of shelters and places like that big camp that's set up in the parking lot at the Walmart in Chico.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, authorities have been diligent about trying to, one, get people to call them, to look at a list of names that has been put out. And if your name is on the list and you are, you know, you are accounted for, if you will, to give a ring to the appropriate agency and let them know so that they can take you off that list and focus elsewhere. In terms of the search, of course, the search inside Paradise has really focused on the burned areas. So,
and let's talk about that search, because you have investigated that search for remains in the burn areas. Who makes up the search teams?
So, at this point, multiple agencies, but it's hundreds of search and rescue personnel at this point are going in to the worst areas and going essentially house by house where they can and combing through what is left, and what is left is ash. And so it's search and recovery teams, but it's also dogs that are specially trained to sniff out human remains. And then these teams are also accompanied by anthropologists who can, for instance, tell you the difference between human remains and animal remains.
And is it kind of a grid, house by house, methodically done, or are searchers targeting in the burn areas specific homes of people on these missing lists?
When I was out with them, they were doing what I believe was an initial sweep, where they were checking houses where they had reason to suspect that someone might not have made it out. Since then, I believe they have widened that effort to be more of a grid-type search.
And you've accompanied these investigators while they're working to identify, to both find the missing and sadly identify human remains. Given the intensity of this fire, how hard is it to find any remains at all, let alone identify them?
It can be quite difficult. In a lot of instances, the fire burns really, really hot. And what that means is that you may not have much left. You might, I hate to be gruesome, but you might just have a bone fragment or a tooth. And so trying to figure out who that person was is very tough. And so what they do then is, you know, if you do find a tooth, for instance, you might be able to use dental records if they haven't also burned up. You know, if there are digital copies, they use medical records. So if someone had a hip replacement, they might be able to use those medical records also to identify someone. Of course, identifying marks like scars or tattoos if they are still visible. Aside from that, they then have to go to what they call circumstantial evidence, which is, okay, say someone is found in a home. Well, who lived in that home? And does the, you know, do the remains that were found match that person or someone else that would have been known to be at that address?
And you wrote about one of the people helping in the effort, California Assemblyman Jim Wood. He's a forensic dentist, and he also did the same thing just a year ago after the Tubbs fire. So what's his background as a forensic dentist?
Well, he was a dentist I want to say decades. And then he became a forensic dentist. And so he actually does this type of work regularly for something like five counties, you know, just helping make IDs where necessary. And so he did this after the Tubbs fire, which I can't even imagine because, of course, you know, Santa Rosa is his district. So the addresses, the areas that that these remains were being found were places that he knew well, addresses that he might have known well.
And just briefly, how long do you expect the search to take?
Oh, goodness. I couldn't even put an estimate on it. And, you know, the sheriff gets asked that pretty much every day at this point. And he says it will take as long as it takes.
Thanks so much for this, Erin Aylworth. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and she's covering the California fires for the paper. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Changing gears now to Southern California's fire damage. The Woolsey Fire has destroyed 1,500 structures and taken the lives of three people. The fire is now 94% contained after burning close to 100,000 acres. Authorities have begun allowing some residents back into Malibu, but officials warn that broken power poles, debris-filled roadways, and broken gas lines still pose serious threats to safety in the area. Laura Rosenthal is a city council member of Malibu, and she joins us now. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So what areas of Malibu have been reopened?
All of Malibu to our city limits, our northern city or western city limits, have now been open to residents. And we are also letting workers and business people in to around the Broad Beach area of Malibu.
And for those of us who haven't seen it, can you give us a sense how extensive the damage is in Malibu? What are you seeing?
It's extremely traumatic, very sad. There are streets and neighborhoods that have been totally devastated. We don't have a count, so I don't want to give you a false number, but it's in the hundreds. I've been on a couple of streets where there's maybe four or five houses still standing, maybe over 40 gone on one street.
And what are you hearing from residents who've already gotten back into the area? What kind of experiences are they having?
Well, as you can imagine, there's different kinds of experiences. There's been a lot of relief for those that come back to an intact house, and a lot of trauma for those that come back. Most people have known whether their houses survived or not. from the people who stayed, and people took pictures. But it can be pretty devastating for those that come back and see the rubble of their former homes. They've sometimes been able to find little pieces of something that survived. And then we have a number of homes, naturally, that were damaged. I was just driving around this morning. I've been driving around all week, but now that more neighborhoods have been opened up, I was out this morning talking with people, saw a lot of trucks for companies that help people with smoke damage inside their homes, and many, many, many utility trucks for Southern California Edison, the gas company, all of the internet companies, cell phone service companies. So we have a lot of people out here. There's still a big sheriff's presence. They have been all over Malibu and extremely helpful, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and also still many, many firefighters from LA County Fire Department.
So a lot of work being done on infrastructure, but what kind of assistance is available to people whose homes have been destroyed, and what kind of housing options in the area?
So there's two things I can mention that are really important. The first one is that on Saturday, we opened the Disaster Assistance Center, and that's at our it's a county courthouse. It's in the Civic Center area. It's right next to LA County Library, the Malibu Library, and that's being run by the county. And there's all different agencies there, from the Red Cross to our building and safety department, to our planning department, to Medicare is there for people that lost their Medicare card. So people can look at the City of Malibu government official Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts, as well as our city website at malibucity.org, to get all of that information. And so we're sending a lot of people there. FEMA also has a trailer there. And then we have a number of organizations that are raising money. I personally am sending people to the Malibu Boys and Girls Club. They're a very trusted presence in Malibu. They have a place at all of our schools, and they have a fund that all of the money is going directly to Malibu residents that have been displaced. We also have many, many teachers that live and work here that also lost their homes, and workers.
What about your story? Well,
I'm very blessed. We actually had sold our family home a couple of years ago and downsized. I'm still in Malibu. I actually can see my old street where I used to live, and that home is gone. So a lot of memories, and difficult for my children, certainly, to see the rubble of that. But my current home survived, and I feel very blessed to be in that situation. And I also am lucky that I've been able to be of service to the people in Malibu, just trying to get out information. It's been very hard. We've been working with, you know, the county organizations, fire and sheriff, really have been calling most of the shots about when streets and neighborhoods would be reopened.
And
so
that's
been working hard to get that information out to our residents.
And that's my next question. How long will it be before all the evacuation orders are lifted?
Well, they're pretty much almost all lifted right now, except for some of our more impacted canyon areas, especially Corral Canyon and Latigo Canyon. We had a lot of damage to power poles there, and they need to helicopter in a lot of those poles because it's very difficult terrain to reach. So, and then we also, on one of our roads, one of the canyon roads, we had a retaining wall fall down that was keeping up some part of the road. So city crews and county crews, some of those canyons, part of them are in the city of Malibu, part of them are in unincorporated LA County. So we've been working very closely together to get those areas open to all. But pretty much everything else in the city right now is open.
Laura Rosenthal is a Malibu City Council member, and we're wishing you and the community the best.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, it's looking like our new sheriff is Alex Villanueva. We'll talk about his background and how he might address the department's long history of scandal and corruption. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. It looks like there's a new sheriff in town. Alex Villanueva declared victory on Friday over incumbent Jim McDonnell. The L.A. registrar still has ballots to count, but at this point it's unlikely McDonnell can close the gap. Villanueva would be taking over the largest sheriff's department in the country, one that has had some significant problems, including allegations of gangs within the department. McDonnell's predecessor, Sheriff Lee Baca, was sentenced to 3 years in prison for obstructing an FBI investigation into the use of excessive force by deputies against inmates in L.A. County Jail. Rafe Sonnenschein is executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State L.A., and he joins us now. Welcome back.
Well, good to talk with you, Barbara.
Let's start with Villanueva's background, because I think a lot of voters didn't really know him that well. He's been with the department for three decades. He was in the U.S. Air Force before that. What else can you tell us about him?
Well, when he was in the department, he rose to the rank of lieutenant and saw himself as kind of a whistleblower and said in his campaign that he had helped reveal information about Sheriff Baca and that he got in conflict with higher-ups because of talking about wrongdoing in the department. So he's very much, what would you call it, an insider-outsider? And it still makes it all the more startling what the election result is.
And he's taking over this big bureaucracy, so what kind of leadership experience does he have?
Well, we have no idea. He's coming in without ever having held a major rank with the supervisory authority he would have, but it's an elected office. Elected officials don't always have to have that kind of supervisory authority. He was supported by the Deputy Sheriff's Union, but was opposed by the association representing the higher-ranking and middle-ranking officers. So already you can imagine there's going to be some tension here, not to mention most of the big elected officials were supporting Sheriff McDonnell. So a lot to do to sort of put together a governing coalition there.
And remind us of the issues this department is dealing with, because, as you say, Villanueva has positioned himself as a whistleblower. Jim McDonnell was elected 4 years ago. He took over from Lee Baca, who was sentenced to prison for obstruction of justice. And there have been these allegations of secret gangs with tattoos within the department. A history of corruption in the department. McDonnell has been trying to put reforms in place. What was he able to accomplish, and where do things stand?
Well, I think it was a work in progress. I think that, oddly enough, they've been fighting over the mantle of being a reformer. And on the tattoo question, Sheriff McDonnell was tougher about trying to get the tattoos out, arguing that when you go in front of a jury, if a sheriff's got a tattoo, the case is pretty much lost for the county. And Villanueva has actually defended the tattoos, saying they're not always indicating a click or something bad. The sheriff also moved to get the records of misconduct by deputy officers out, and Villanueva was not in favor of that. But the biggest difference that attracted the most attention was over dealings with ICE on immigration. And Sheriff McDonnell was kind of in the middle ground on that, not as pro-sanctuary as, say, the city of L.A. was, and Villanueva obtained a tremendous amount of progressive support for being a little more critical about ICE being able to work in and around the jails, although he may disappoint some people when he gets in. It's not quite clear if his differences are as stark as they appeared.
Yeah, you're anticipating my next question, which was, how surprised were you by his win over McDonnell, and how much was this election a referendum on immigration policy and Trump rather than reforming the sheriff's department?
I think at the end of the day, this election on the inside may have been something about anger over some of the sheriff's policies, especially from the deputy sheriffs. But on the outside, I think this ended up all about Donald Trump. As these days, it seems like everything ends up all about Donald Trump. The fact that Sheriff McDonald was kind of in the middle on immigration and seen as not as supportive of the sanctuary state law, as many sheriffs have been in that position, I think this became a major voting issue. And I, you know, certainly committees that were campaigning against McDonald had pictures of Donald Trump in their advertising. And as you can see, everywhere in California, anything that connects you in any way to Donald Trump is toxic. And there was a very high turnout of Latino voters, and they went heavily to a fairly unknown candidate who also had the endorsement of the Democratic Party, while many of the elected officials were with the sheriff.
And does that explain why the Democrats supported Villanueva over McDonald?
Yeah, they may. What I will have to wait to see is whether he turns out to be the progressive that they were hoping he would be. And we just don't know. Some of his comments about immigration seem to kind of not mark out that big a difference with the sheriff. We'll just have to wait and see. But this is a year where the immigration issue in Southern California really drew a coalition together. And once it became identified with Villanueva, but to go back to your first question, I'd like to say I predicted this, but that would be ridiculous. I would say that the worst thing that happened to Sheriff McDonald was it was too easy for him to get elected the first time. There was barely any opposition. It was almost like an appointment in 2014 to bring him in to fix a troubled sheriff's department. And I'm not sure he was quite ready to actually run a campaign that was as competitive as this one was. And I think in normal worlds, the 2014 one would have been monstrously hard for an open seat. And then this one would have been an easy reelection, but instead it was the reverse.
And just to remind listeners, the race hasn't been called yet, but it's looking like Villanueva will be the winner. What do you expect his priorities will be if he is indeed the new sheriff?
Well, it's really hard to say. I think that the deputy sheriffs are going to want him to support their positions in some issues that are identified as reform questions. In certain disciplinary matters. I think the real defining one for the big coalition he put together is, does he do something significantly different in immigration policy that would be distinguished from what Sheriff McDonald does? If he doesn't, I think you'll start to see some disappointment set in.
Well, there you have it. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Coming up, we're getting into the spirit of the harvest holiday with a new book called Feast. It's a look at food of the Islamic world.
The food is very delicious, regardless of all the countries I've been to and how different it is from one place to another. But it still is a pretty interesting and, if not uniform, a kind of cohesive world.
That's next. Don't press play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. How do you condense all the cuisines of the Islamic world into one cookbook? After all, there are around 50 Muslim-majority countries. They span from Morocco on the eastern Atlantic to Indonesia in the South Pacific. And that doesn't even include the predominantly Muslim regions within other countries like China and India. Chef Anissa Helu was undaunted by this challenge. Her latest cookbook is called Feast, Food of the Islamic World. It features more than 300 recipes from dozens of countries, from Afghanistan to Zanzibar. Madeline Brand recently spoke with Helu about her new book.
Wow. So you think big.
I do. In this case.
Yes. So how did you come up with this idea that you needed to condense all of these cuisines into one cookbook?
Well, it actually came from another idea. My agent wanted me to write a comprehensive and updated book on Middle Eastern food. But, you know, Claudia Roden had written the definitive one, even though it had been published a long time ago. So I kind of mulled it over and decided not to do it. And after the Arab Spring, I was looking at the coverage of Islam, Muslim people, and gradually how it kind of, they became both vilified in the press by different governments, etc. And I thought that a good way to present the religion and its people is through food and to talk about the history, the civilizations, the culture, and how rich it all was and still is. And the food is very delicious, regardless of all the countries I've been to and how different it is from one place to another. But it still is a pretty interesting and, if not uniform, a kind of cohesive world. Mm. So I came up with the idea. My agent liked it.
And then you had to actually do the work.
Exactly.
So what did that entail? Because did you go to the origins being what, Medina?
Yeah,
in
absolutely.
Saudi Arabia, yeah. In the 600s or so?
Yeah, 622, I think, is the first year of Hijra. And 610, I think, is when the Prophet Muhammad had his first revelation. I did actually study the history. I read parts of the Quran, and I started following the history of the food from the different empires, starting with the Umayyad when they established their capital in Damascus, and finishing with the Mughals in India, because these are the great civilizations. And so I kind of followed the historical trail and also chose the countries according to the population, the number of population majority Muslim, and also the cuisines. Like if there were similarities, I chose the countries where the cuisine was, in my opinion, like more interesting or richer or with more variety.
And what would that be?
So if you take, let's say, Indonesia and Malaysia, you know, I had a deadline, so I had to deliver the book. So I chose Indonesia over Malaysia, but I could have chosen Malaysia. The food is different, but it's close enough for me to kind of, Indonesia being the largest population, Muslim population in the world. So I chose to go there and research Indonesian food as against get deeper into Malaysian food. But I will eventually go there. Or let's say Turkey, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Palestine. Even though each has its own food, I concentrated on Turkey because of the Ottoman Empire, Syria and Lebanon because I'm half Syrian, half Lebanese, and also they have great cuisines. So I kind of chose, I hope judiciously, and also on a personal, you know, a bit of a personal note.
So make the link, if you would, through food between Medina in Saudi Arabia and Indonesia. What links those two? How would you have similar meals in those two different places?
Well, it would be, spices would be a link because the trade of spices was very important. The important occasions and the kebabs in Medina and satay in Indonesia.
Oh, interesting.
In fact, if there is one group of food that you find across, is kebabs.
Why the kebab rather than another form of meat? Is it because it's easily transportable?
That's an interesting question. I didn't think about it that way. I think it's maybe through the Turkish travelers and something to do with like cooking quickly over charcoal fire. I mean, all over the Islamic world, you have street food. A lot of street food in some countries, a bit less in others. But to cook meat quickly, you cut it up in pieces or mince it, put it on skewers, and in 5 minutes you have an important protein.
And you can take it to go when
exactly.
You're riding your camel. And speaking of camels, I want to get to the show-stopping recipe in your book, the roasted camel hump. which is no joke. You actually talk about roasting a hump, but you can't just buy a hump, right?
No, you can't.
You have to have the whole animal.
Before I started writing the book, I did a TV series called El Chef Yekteshef, or The Chef Discovers, going around the Emirates with a co-presenter who was a wonderful poet. And one of the episodes was a camel feast. And, you know, the grandees of these countries, they have a separate room called majlis, which is a reception room. And this room is reserved to men. Occasionally, they will let women in, but very occasionally. The women will have their own majlis. So, you know, the producers were talking about this amazing, you know, party, camel, the camel hump and all this, and we were going there. And so we go in our convoy of cars and we arrive at the compound because they have different houses, including the majlis. I get out of the car and the producer sends me somewhere else. And he says, you can't come with us. And I said, what about the camel hump? He said, well, you can't come to the majlis because you're a woman and we'll send you some. They never sent me any, so it became an obsession. Luckily, 2 days later, I was in a catering kitchen. They were preparing another camel feast, and I got a tiny taste. It wasn't a revelation, to be honest. But
what did it taste like?
Kind of between lamb and meat. It was a little bit tough. You know, the spices were nice, but it wasn't like...
Is there a lot of meat on the hump?
There's a lot of fat, yeah. And under the fat, you have like two fillets against the spine. So
that's the prize of the
hump.
That's
the prize of the camel hump. And also the fact that it is one bit of the animal, whereas you have, you know, like two legs, two shoulders, chops, etc.
Is it considered the delicacy of the camel?
Yeah.
The hump?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the centerpiece of that.
Of the animal and of the feast.
But then I thought of writing an article and I went to my friend and I said, I need a camel because you can't buy a camel hump. And she very kindly gave me a beautiful baby camel, which I watched being slaughtered, butchered. And I took my camel hump with me to my brother's flat, who happens to be based in Dubai. Both my brother and his housekeeper were horrified by what I had brought back.
You're just
home.
Holding a hump?
I was. I think it was wrapped. But when I uncovered it in the kitchen, the housekeeper... what had like her eyes went really wide open. And my brother was like, what are you going to do? Like, can't we buy a regular leg of lamb or something?
Well, how that does raise the question, how do you cook such a thing?
Well, actually, I marinated it in this wonderful Emirati marinade, which has rose water, saffron, spices, and a bit of garlic. And basted it with a kind of another, you know, sauce with tamarind, rose water and saffron. And I roasted it a bit like a leg of lamb, but longer. And then, you know, served it by slitting at the bottom of the hump and getting the meat out. And it was the best ever piece of camel hump I ever ate. After that, I never had any more.
But you do have a recipe in your book for it, in case we want to try it.
Where in the United States could we get a camel hump?
Yeah.
I don't know. You can get camel meat frozen, but not camel hump. I doubt it. Unless you go to a camel farm and they have the right type of camel.
Well, I admire your adventurousness on that.
Thank you.
Yes, that's so. If you don't want to be as adventurous as trying to find a camel hump, you have meatballs in sour cherry sauce.
Yes.
This is just made from regular lamb.
Yes,
and a sour cherry sauce. Can you talk about this recipe?
This is the quintessential recipe of Aleppo. In Syria, which is considered the gastronomic capital of the Middle East. And the interesting thing about a lot of the food in the book and in the Islamic world is that it's very seasonal. So this particular recipe, I never tasted with fresh cherries because I was never in Syria at the right time. But luckily, now that I live in Sicily, they have the same sour cherries and I can make it there.
But you can't use regular cherries.
No, because it would be too sweet. They're sour cherries. You can use dried sour cherries and rehydrate them. And then it's not, you know, it's a slightly different result from fresh cherries, but it's still very good. And it's a very interesting dish that illustrates the use of sweet and savory and cooking fruit with meat, which is very typical of, you know, that a part of that world, and comes down from the Persians.
So you mentioned Syria. You're from Syria, or you're half Syrian, I should say. How has the war affected, you said this is the headquarters of this cuisine, Aleppo. How has the war changed all that, changed the cuisine of the Middle East?
Well, it has destroyed, to start with, the war has destroyed the souks of Aleppo, which were the most enchanting of the Middle East. There is one positive that has come out of this tragedy, and that is with the number of refugees that have spread around the world, the Syrian cuisine has become better known because a lot of these refugees have used their natural talent for cooking to start businesses, catering, restaurants, you know, whatever. You know, before the war, very few people knew about Syrian cuisine except those who had visited Syria. And now there is a, you know, a thirst. But the on the minus side is you have all these refugees who are much less well off than when they were in their country. I remember talking to a refugee family in Lebanon, and the woman was kind of so sad that she wasn't able to cook the way she cooked in Syria. She didn't have the money to buy meat, to buy rice. So, you know, in a slower way, the culinary lore and the recipes might, some of them might be lost.
Is that one reason why you wanted
yes,
to do this
absolutely.
Book as well? To preserve this culture and preserve this history?
Absolutely. And that's all my work is based. I mean, the philosophy, you know, I write my books with the intent of preserving traditional recipes, researching them and passing them on to the future, you know, generations.
And so how do you do that when people aren't there to research?
I was very lucky to have been brought up in Lebanon and Syria and to have gone a lot to Syria before the war. But I wish that I had actually written a book about Syrian food when Syria was a country that you could visit and you could go anywhere and research. And I had the contacts to do it. But no publisher was interested. I guess I could have done it on my own, but I didn't. There are some people who have done it before, and there are people who have written books after. But, you know, when the country is at war and you cannot visit it, even if you eat the food abroad, it's not quite the same as when you eat it in the country. So that's why I keep, you know, recording the recipes and having a reference for people who want to know what it, you know, what it would have been cooked, prepared like in the country of origin or traditionally.
And for us, if we are not of these cultures and don't really know this cuisine, is it easy for us to cook these meals? have you made it simpler for us?
I have not compromised. I believe in simplicity in the kitchen. I don't believe in complicating people's life. So I simplify where I can, but I don't compromise on, let's say, authenticity is a kind of charge word, but I don't compromise on the flavors, on the ingredients. I don't tell you to use spinach instead of some sort of weird green that has a completely different flavor. I say, this is how it should be prepared.
Go and get this it. Is... And...
but if you want to prepare it with spinach, you're going to have something quite different.
So, caveat emptor. I guess you can't make a camel hump with anything but a camel hump, really. There's no substitution.
You cannot call it camel hump. You can have a leg of lamb.
It's entirely different. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Madeleine.
That's chef and cookbook author Anissa Helou. Her latest book is called Feast, Food of the Islamic World.
Well, coming up, our legal correspondent Jessica Levinson on the legal drama surrounding the White House and CNN's Jim Acosta. And she'll also unpack the process of ruling on the new citizenship question in the U.S. Census. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. The White House said today it will fully restore the press pass of CNN's Jim Acosta. And in response, CNN has said it will drop the lawsuit it filed to get the pass reinstated. Both sides met in court last week, and the case seemed headed for a drawn-out legal battle over freedom of the press. Well, Jessica Levinson is here to talk about this and other recent legal dramas. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal correspondent. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Okay, so wind us back. Take us back to the beginning of this this tit for tat back and forth between the White House and CNN's Jim Acosta.
Yes. Well, let's begin at the beginning of this particular episode, which is really kind of the middle of a much longer fight between President Trump and CNN. And so, what happened last week is that Jim Acosta of CNN had a very tense exchange with President Trump. And not coincidentally, later that day, Jim Acosta was stripped of his press credentials for the White House briefing room. Jim Acosta sued, along with CNN, and they alleged First Amendment and Fifth Amendment violations. And the judge preliminarily said, you know what, Jim Acosta, I think you might succeed on the merits of at least the Fifth Amendment claim, and I'm going to tell you, you need your press pass back for 14 days. Now, at that point, Jim Acosta had a small victory in the case, but it's important to know the judge didn't rule on anything dealing with the First Amendment rights, which was kind of the big meaty issue that many of us were waiting for.
Right, the freedom of the press rights or free speech. And this ruling came down on Friday, that he'd temporarily get his press pass back. But you're talking about the Fifth Amendment. How do both the First and Fifth Amendments come into play in this case?
Right, so the Fifth Amendment deals with due process, and the Fifth Amendment comes into play because Jim Acosta and CNN made an allegation that if you're going to strip me of my press pass, you have to tell me why, and then you have to give me a time to respond and to contest that why. And what the judge said on Friday is just, Jim Acosta is right on that particular point. Again, nothing to do with Jim Acosta's right that what you did smacks of censorship or violates the First Amendment in any way. So then last night, it looked like the White House said, you know what, Jim Acosta, when your 14 days is up, your press pass is up too, and we're going to revoke your press pass again. Jim Acosta goes back to the court this morning, says, I'm filing another emergency request. I want a hearing on November 28th. I want you to say I get my press pass while this whole case is being decided. Then later today, what happens? The suit this essentially evaporates before our eyes. And what we're left with is a Trump administration who has now said on the record that they believe anybody can be kicked out of the press room, even if the reason they're kicked out of the press room is that they don't like the message of what the reporter is reporting.
Well, we're left with that, but also we don't know why the White House backed off. You want to hazard an answer to that?
Well, so there are a number of different, so now we're in the kind of tea leaves area. The judge that was deciding this case was actually a Trump nominee and had made some comments on the record that some people thought were, in a sense, favorable to Trump, but saying, I'm constrained by case precedent. And I think, again, if we want to read the tea leaves, what we could say is Trump administration looked at this judge, realized that he felt duty-bound to follow the case precedent. There's some precedent from about 41 years ago that I think indicates Jim Acosta had a really good case and that the White House just didn't want another recent ruling on that particular issue.
Okay, a fascinating mess and with some very, portending some interesting things about democracy. But we have to turn to our other story in the news. The Supreme Court has decided to hear arguments in a case concerning the question about citizenship on the next census. Tell us about that.
Yes. So this is actually a case within a case, or a play within a play, as we want to say. So the Supreme Court is going to hear arguments just on a very narrow issue of whether or not we can take the deposition of the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, who is the man who apparently said, I want to add a question in the census which asks about citizenship.
Right. So very controversial because it could mean that many immigrants might not want to even answer that question or take part in the census, so it could affect the tally.
Exactly. And there's some breaking news just a few moments ago that there is some evidence that there may have been discussions between Wilbur Ross and, I believe this is what it said, between Wilbur Ross and law enforcement about sharing that citizenship information, whereas the census information is typically confidential, therefore giving much more fuel to the fire of those saying many people in the immigrant community are going to be very reticent to answer the census question. So a number of states, including California, Maryland, and the Maryland have sued and said, you cannot ask this question about citizenship on the census. Now, within those suits, there's a question of whether or not you can depose Wilbur Ross, because we want to know his motivations for asking about the citizenship question, and that's the question that the Supreme Court is going to hear in February.
Okay, and by sharing, you meant sharing the census responses with possibly law enforcement and the national security agencies, correct?
Exactly.
So, all right, so this is just this kind of preliminary, as you said, a lawsuit within a lawsuit idea. Why wouldn't or couldn't Ross be compelled to testify right now? Why is this ruling necessary?
Well, essentially, what he's arguing is, Judge, you have enough to go on. You already have all the documents in this case. I've turned over memos. I've turned over emails. I've turned over plenty for you to give your ruling. And I'm a very busy person, and I'm the type of person who you should not be able to compel to give a deposition in this setting. Now, what plaintiffs have said is, but your intent goes to the heart of this question as to whether or not adding citizenship is legitimate or not. And we need to hear from you, not just your documents, not just your emails, but we actually need to hear from you under oath. This might sound similar to a conversation we're having about whether or not Robert Mueller can ask President Trump to come in and answer questions.
Finish your thought.
So just as to this issue, that's what the Supreme Court is looking at, whether or not we can compel Wilbur Ross to sit for a deposition.
And what should we expect next then?
Well, we're going to expect the Supreme Court to hear oral arguments, and then we're going to expect everybody to watch and see if the vote comes down along partisan affiliation lines. And I truly hope that it does not. I truly hope that the court looks at this and that there's, frankly, some crossover between the kind of jurisprudential aisle, and that the court has at the very least a united front on this, because it is so politically charged, and this is a moment where the nation does not want to see more division in the Supreme Court.
Well, I hope for your sake and for all of ours that's the case. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jessica Levinson, she's a law professor at Loyola Law School. Thanks again. And that's a cue for Christian Bordahl.
Hey there,
feedback.
Barbara.
Hi.
Nice to have you back with us.
It is nice to see your face across the desk.
So we heard earlier about Islamic cuisine, which was very interesting, particularly the camel hump specialty.
Right, which camel hump cannot be made out of anything but camel hump.
Hump, the hump of camel, yes. So I asked listeners for something a little closer to home about favorite and not so favorite Thanksgiving dishes. Kat Morse responded, baby camel hump, yum. Joking, that was disgusting. Corinne says,
kind of good.
Stuffing is my favorite, but it's a pass on the canned cranberry dressing, homemade only. Green Bean Casserole Palmer, that's literally his Twitter name. Green Bean Casserole Palmer says, I'll have to think about that one. Christian Hokanson.
Does he change his name, his handle every holiday?
Maybe he does, yes, every holiday. Christmas, it'll be something different. Christian Hokanson says the favorite is turkey sandwiches, but ick to stuffing with raisins. No raisins in the stuffing, please. Fernando Aquina says we all know stuffing is the main event, with maybe turkey on the side. And I asked him what kind of stuffing he's really into. He said chorizo stuffing. Reminds me of warm Sunday mornings when I was a kid and my mom would call me down for breakfast.
Oh, yum. Clearly you asked the most controversial question you could ever ask in the feedback. I think so. Yeah, that was great. Thanks, everybody, for talking with us. And that's it for us for today on Press Play. Thanks also for listening. I'll see you back here tomorrow.